Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Hopeful Environmentalist, a podcast where we discuss hope and ways to take action in the climate space. It's your host, Taylor Gannis, and today we're talking about a topic that's been flooding the news recently. So if you haven't seen, the world has officially passed its first global tipping point, and the news has had a lot to say about it, from it's too late to act, to we can't go back. And you might have even read the news and thought, are we screwed? Is it too late to act? You might have even felt scared or hopeless. And to be honest, when I read the news, I felt the same exact way. I felt a lot of different emotions. I felt scared. I felt hopeless. I felt like it's too late to act. And I heard from a lot of you that you also felt these emotions. You also felt this confusion and you had a lot of questions. And I wanted to answer these questions for you. So that's why I decided to bring on an expert, somebody who helped to write the actual report and someone who is a scientist behind the report, to come onto the podcast to answer these questions and to talk about, are we screwed? Is it too late? And I'll give you a little hint because I don't want you to be on edge the whole episode. It's not too late. And we talk about all of the reasons why it's not too late. We do talk about why it's a dire situation and what the report is, what a global tipping point is, and what the report is saying. But we also talk and dive into hope, solutions, how we can move forward to create a future we all deserve. So without further ado, I'd love to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Steve Smith. Dr. Steve Smith is the Tipping Points Research Impact Fellow at Green Future Solutions and the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. He was a lead author of the Global Tipping Points Report 2023 and 2025 and co-leads the Global Systems Institute's ongoing research and translation of positive tipping points in technology, economy, and society. Steve is also a Hoffman Fellow at the World Economic Forum, Geneva, where he's responsible for thought leadership and translation of positive tipping points, insights for industry, business, and policymaking. So again, without further ado, I'd love to welcome Dr. Steve Smith to The Hopeful Environmentalist. Super excited for this conversation today. And I know the listeners are as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to thank you very much for inviting me, Taylor.
So to start, could you please explain to us what the Global Tipping Points Report 2025 is and what your role was in creating this report?
Yes, yeah, so the Global Tipping Points Report 2025, it's a very large and detailed assessment of the global state of the climate situation with regards to what we call tipping points in the Earth system. So these are, we've identified up to 25 areas of the Earth system which have the potential for tipping points, which means that they go into very sudden and abrupt collapse, irreversible collapse, if these tipping points are crossed. But we also go into other areas of the issue, including climate change governance, what we need to do to govern the situation. And also we take a look at the positive tipping points, which is the optimistic kind of tipping points that we want to promote to get us out of the carbon economy and into a new clean economy.
And what makes this report so different from other reports?
Well, this is the only Global Tipping Points report. We did our first one in 2023, and in the 2 years since we published that one, the world has witnessed some really big changes that puts us in a new climate reality, which in both good and bad ways. So we can now say that unfortunately we have passed the first major climate tipping point, which is the wide-scale damage to the warm water coral reefs around the world, because they have passed their thermal tipping point because of climate change and other stresses. But on the other side, we've also passed at least one major positive tipping point in the energy transition. So, for example, the electricity, the clean technology electricity revolution has reached exponential growth, so that from the first half of this year, 2025, the growth in solar electricity generation and wind electricity generation supplied more than the growth in electricity demand. So, which means that for the first time in history, for the first time in the fossil fuel era, the fossil fuel generation electricity is now in structural decline.
Well, that is absolutely amazing to hear. And I know, as the hopeful environmentalists, we love to talk about the hopeful parts, but we also need to talk about the parts that are they're not so hopeful. And I know you already spoke a little bit about it, but I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen the headlines sharing that warm water coral reefs are now crossing their thermal tipping point. And a lot of these headlines have been super scary. Like, we've passed this point of no return and everything's doomed. I've seen a bunch of them. They've given me anxiety. So could you please explain in like lay terms what this actually means and why it matters and the consequences that this could have?
Yeah, so since 2023, since we did the last report, we've witnessed over a year of temperatures above 1.5 degree Celsius above the pre-industrial average. And the long-term average is now around sort of 1.4 degrees Celsius, which overshoots the limit set 10 years ago in the Paris Agreement. Looks inevitable over the next coming years, and it could happen as soon as 2030. So what this means is that this just puts the world into this new danger zone of escalating risk of more tipping points being crossed. As far as the coral reefs are concerned, marine heat waves have hit 80% of the world's warm water coral reefs, with the worst bleaching event on record. And the response of these reefs confirms that the widespread dieback of warm water coral reefs is already underway, which is going to impact hundreds of millions of people who depend on reefs for fishing and tourism and coastal protection from rising seas and storm surges. That does not mean that all coral reefs are doomed. It means that we have to fight and do everything we can and try even harder to save what we possibly can of reefs and to decarbonize as fast as we can. Not all reefs will die all at once. It depends on the situation and the geography and many different factors. So, and there's a lot of great work being done to preserve as many reefs as we can. But the situation is unfortunately perilous. We've known about the sensitivity of reefs for decades, and when I first started in my career over 35 years ago, we knew then that we had to decarb. We had to take at least 60% of the carbon dioxide emissions, reduce them by at least 60%, and instead we've increased them by 60%, and the result is warming atmosphere, warming oceans, acidification of oceans, and these all affect the reefs. So, as I say, it doesn't mean to say that we will never have we have lost all reefs. It just means that we have to try harder to save what we can and do as much as we can to begin to stabilize the temperature and even begin reducing the carbon dioxide concentrations over time.
Yeah, I think that was a great explanation because I feel like a lot of the news outlets, they're covering this in a way of like it's doomed, it's over, all the coral are gone. So I think that was a great and needed explanation of kind of clarifying what the news is saying. So I think this was a great explanation. So thank you for that. And the report also opens up by stating the world has entered a new reality. And I know you've kind of explained that a bit, but do you mind going a little more in depth of what that actually means?
Yeah, the new reality is that we can no longer think about normally in life, in the way that we plan things, the way that government works, the way that we think about our lives is all about slow incremental change. That's the way that we plan our policies and our infrastructures and everything. And normally that's fine because usually things do happen slowly. But we're now entering a new reality in which things are happening all at once. Things are accelerating, and we have to think about how we are going to adapt to things that we can't change, and think about how we need to become much more urgent about how we try to prevent these abrupt tipping points, which are not linear, they're not incremental, they're not slow, they're fast, and they can accelerate. And once they're past a certain point, they're very difficult to reverse.
Yeah, and I think something I try to do with people, like my own friends and family is trying to get this into perspective for them is like, so I live in New York and we used to get a lot of snow when I was younger, and all of a sudden now we're not getting any snow. So that's kind of a way I'd like to describe it to people of this change is happening so fast. It's happening right before our eyes. It's not something that's in the distant future. It's something that's here and we have to address it head on now. So what other Earth systems are also nearing their tipping points?
Yeah, so we've mentioned the coral reefs already. That's the sort of the canary in the coal mine sort of system that we've known for a very long time is very sensitive to temperature rise. The other things that are closest to tipping that have really serious consequences if they do tip, but they're not necessarily happening yet, are things like the Greenland ice sheet. That might not seem of interest or relevance to, you know, to people sitting at home or listening to this, but the Greenland ice sheet is melting at a rate, losing fresh water into the Atlantic Ocean at a rate of 30 million tons an hour, which to try to visualize what 30 million tons an hour looks like, if anybody's ever been to Niagara Falls, it's sort of three of it's more than three of those all at once, and that's water pouring into the North Atlantic Ocean. Apart from the fact that I mean, one thing to say is that the complete melting of the Greenland ice sheet will take hundreds of years. But if and when it does melt completely, it will raise sea level by about 7 meters, which would be the end of New York, and it would be the end of London, it would be the end of most coastal cities. But that would happen over hundreds of years. More imminently, more immediately, the problem with the Atlantic ice sheets and the polar ice sheets is that all of this fresh water is destabilizing the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, what we call the AMOC. If that and that system has shut down, it's one of these classic tipping point systems where you've got two alternative stable states and it kind of tips from one to the other. And when it goes into the other, it stays in that stable state for a while and then it tips back again. So it's a kind of an on-off switch, rather like a sort of thermostat on an off, it has an on position and an off position. When it's in its off position, which has happened in various times in geological history, that would massively change not only the temperature of Northwest Europe, which would put us into a new sort of mini ice age, but it won't happen straight away. It'll take a few decades. But also, it will affect the sea levels on the eastern seaboard of the US, and it'll affect the climate globally. It will affect the Amazon rainforest. It will even affect the melting of the Antarctic polar ice caps as well. And it'll affect the monsoons in Africa and India and potentially threaten half of the growing regions for maize and wheat in the world. This is not just about just melting ice sheets in a place that you've never heard of. It's about the cascading effects from one tipping point to another and affecting the climate and the agricultural ability to grow food and many other things that will be quite devastating. So these are tipping points that we really desperately have to avoid if we can.
And I think that's such an important point of, just because you don't see the Greenland ice sheets or you might never go to Antarctica, these places all impact us. We're all on the same earth, right? It all impacts us in some way. The impact might be felt different from someone who might live in Greenland, but we will still be feeling those effects all across the world in different ways. So thank you for explaining that. And are there any other types of cascading tipping effects in the report that any other examples that the report gives?
Yes, I mean the Amazon rainforest is another one. We've lost about 17% of the area of the Amazon rainforest, and there is a tipping point there which is estimated to be roughly sort of in the early 20s percentage, you know, sort of 20, 22%. So if that tipped, then the Amazon rainforest itself, which is obviously a huge important area for species biodiversity, but also of carbon removals itself, because obviously the trees absorb carbon dioxide. The loss of the Amazon rainforest or the collapse to down to a sort of a semi-arid scrub region would be devastating for the climate, not only of the region that supports 100 million people, but also again will affect the climate in other continents as well. and it'll affect the rainfall patterns globally. Just the although we might not think that 1.5 degrees of warming is very much, throughout the tropical regions, there is a sort of a physiological tipping point in the human body whereby beyond sort of around 29, 30 degrees, there is what we call the wet bulb temperature limit, whereby heat becomes unsurvivable. So even though we might think, oh, a little bit warmer is no big problem, in the tropics, as we go above the limit of 1.5 and get towards the 2 degree limit, which is where we're heading, large areas of the tropics may become unlivable, and which would cause obviously agriculture to break down, but it would also force people to be displaced. And obviously, we want to avoid that awful trauma and agony of displacement and all of the civil unrest and misery that comes with that. So those are a few others. We can go on and on and on with various other tipping points, but I think those are the few that really worry me most, I think, is the AMOC collapse and the wet bulb temperature for the tropical areas, which, if crossed, could cause the displacement and breakdown of society throughout the tropical regions.
Yeah, so things are definitely dire, and you've said before we need fast action. And in the report calls tipping points a global governance challenge. What does this mean, and how are we currently failing to manage that risk?
Yes, it's a really good question because often we overlook this the very important issue of governance. How we're not used to thinking about tipping points. Our governance systems, our institutions, really need to address this new reality, because abrupt and irreversible tipping points pose a very different type and magnitude of threat to the other environmental challenges that we face. And the current policies that we have are not enough to prevent further tipping points from happening. People imagine, and there are these scenarios and models that assume that even if we go above the 1.5 limit into the 2 degrees limit, and towards the end of the century, we might be able to stabilize, under 2 degrees, and so on. These kinds of scenarios and governance ideas do not take into account the possibility of tipping points. So we really are calling on leaders to act to integrate the concept of and the risks of tipping points into the assessments that they make, and just add urgency to the governance challenge that we have in this COP and future COPs, and also in national and subnational governance as well. If we wait for tipping points to be crossed and assume that things are all always going to carry on, just getting slightly worse, then if we wait for those tipping points to be crossed, it'll be too late. So we have to act preemptively to decarbonize as fast as possible and to adapt to those changes that we can no longer avoid. And also, I should mention that acting locally is also important, because we need to reduce the other stresses and drivers that are causing this ecosystem collapses, like the overfishing of coral reefs and the destruction of the rainforests. There are various other things that we need to act locally to stop these drivers and help increase the resilience of these ecosystems to resist the tipping point and give local communities more agency over their fate as well.
I always love to stress as well the local impact and the local importance. I always feel like there's, well, global importance is important and very much needed, but we also need action on the local level. So I love that you brought that up. And I know you also discussed COP a little bit. Can you tell us what COP 30 is and what will be important going into it?
COP, there have been 29 previous COPs all the way back to 1995 was the first one in Berlin. And so now we're on COP30 in Belém in Brazil. Each year they're in different parts of the world. The next one, COP31, is either going to be in Australia or possibly Turkey. So the purpose of them is that all the nations of the world, and also a lot of the non-state actors, whether they're sort of city coalitions or NGOs or various other observers and negotiators, all get together to just take stock of how the challenge to decarbonize the atmosphere is going. In the Paris Agreement, which was 10 years ago now, 2015, in the Paris COP, it was agreed that we should limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, and if possible, as low as 1.5, which, as I've mentioned before, we have failed to limit below 1.5. We will overshoot that limit. And so the purpose of COP is to agree ways, and this is one of its some people would say its strengths, but also its weaknesses, that you need a consensus of nations to agree on how to proceed, including how to provide finance for countries to help them transition from the existing sort of carbon intensive economy and so on to the new renewable energy economy. And also, so there are various different subject areas, from energy production to agriculture to understanding how to provide the finance to provide access to countries to do this transition, and how to compensate countries that are already suffering what they call the loss and damage negotiations. So there's all these different kinds of negotiations going on. Every 5 years, nations are obliged to what they call ratchet up their ambition. So every year they produce these nationally determined contributions, or what they think that they can do to reduce carbon in their economies. And every 5 years, those contributions are reassessed and hopefully ratcheted up to make them more ambitious. Not all countries have decided to submit their contributions for this year, but for example, China has just done so today, and it's a big one because obviously it's a huge economy, and they've just announced that their emissions are going to peak imminently, if that they already have really, and that they're going to start reducing their emissions by at least 10% by 2035, which it's still nowhere near fast enough. Let's be honest, but it's certainly more. It's good news in terms of what they promised up to now. Other countries like the USA are not involved, obviously, because of the new administration there. And there are coalitions of countries, for example, the low-lying nations, who are concerned not just for a rapid transition, but for their very survival as the sea is rising. So there's lots of different coalitions and nations and people trying to negotiate over a 2 week period to try to solve the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced.
So a very important conference for sure. Thank you for describing that. I have never been to a COP for that. I've been to COP for the biological diversity, and wow, a lot happens in just a few weeks. So can definitely say that it is a hectic time and a very important time as well. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, the report describes tipping points as a human rights issue. Can you share how climate tipping points intersects with justice, and particularly for vulnerable communities?
Yes, of course. When scientists provide information to policymakers, and they tend to use sort of global averages for things, it can mask or hide the fact that the majority of the problem has been caused by the richest nations, whereas the majority of the vulnerability and the risk falls on the poorer nations, who are least able to do anything about it, and least able to sort of adapt to the problem. So the first human rights issue is the simple fact that the rich nations have become rich because they have burned so much fossil fuels. That's how we've industrialized. And the poorer nations, they would also like the sort of health and lifestyle benefits that the richer world have, but of course they can't follow our lead because we wouldn't survive if the developing nations were as carbon intensive as the richer nations were. So we have an obligation to help them leapfrog the industrial revolution, if you like, and go straight to the renewable energy economy as fast as we can. So we have this human rights obligation to help the developing nations finance a new economy. We also have to bear in mind that this is a huge energy transition for mostly, and what we're attempting to do is to transform the energetic basis of the entire human society within a generation, and that's never been done before. It's an enormous undertaking. In our haste to do it as quickly as possible, we can sometimes overlook the marginalized and vulnerable people, often who whose communities are lying in the face of the critical materials and minerals and so on that we desperately need for our batteries and our solar panels and so on. So in our rush to create this new economy, we also have to be aware that we cannot do this by creating what we call sort of green sacrifice zones of areas and communities that are just obliterated in our desire to get those new raw ingredients for the renewable energy economy. So we have to do with fairness and justice and using all of the human rights that we know that everybody deserves, regardless of where they live. At the same time, we can't ignore the people who are going to be made redundant from the fossil fuel economy. There are millions, tens of millions of people, farmers, industrialists, people working in mines and oil rigs and so on, and working on internal combustion engine cars and other things that we have to find alternative employment for these people, and to help reskill the people who are currently involved in that fossil fuel economy. We have a human obligation to those to help that transition to make it just and fair to everybody.
Yeah, there's a lot that needs to go into it for sure. And I've heard people talk about too, like the systems that have gotten us here cannot be the systems that continue on and will get us out of it, because the systems that have extracted will not be the things that get us out.
Another really important thing to remember, which is often overlooked, is that certainly in my country, in the UK, there's an awful lot of money going into offshore wind, for example, which is a great idea, and it's certainly more environmentally friendly than the fossil fuel incumbent sort of energy mix that we had before. But in our haste, in our rush to throw a lot of money into extremely large projects, we also have to think about this opportunity, this amazing opportunity that we have, the first time in history to provide access to electricity to people who have never had it, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. There are hundreds of, well, over the world, there are something like 800 or 900 million people who've never had electricity. That's so we have this amazing opportunity to provide, especially solar, distributed, off the grid energy to people who've never had electricity before. But also, even in our countries, we have this amazing opportunity to become energy independent, have energy democracy, so that, cooperative, small solar and wind generating plants can be run and managed and owned by their own communities. And I think it would be a terrible shame if we miss this opportunity to create that kind of energy democracy world. Because if we fail to do that, then we might end up with the same half a dozen major energy companies controlling our energy and charging and making just obscene profits from it. So I think it'd be much better and a human rights issue in itself if we could generate the kind of energy that we're in control of.
Yeah, and what you're describing now, makes me excited for the future of what we could build. We can build a clean economy that doesn't extract and that is helpful to all people. So it makes me very hopeful for the future to talk like that and to hear about the possibilities that we can create and that these possibilities exist. We just have to choose it. So you and your colleagues, and now kind of going into that positive tone, is you and your colleagues write that we're not just at risk of these negative tipping points, but we can actually trigger positive ones. And I know you described it a little bit in the beginning, but can you give us some examples of what this means and just examples of these positive tipping points?
It's a really great question. Thank you. And it's important to note that the Global Tipping Points report isn't just about the scary Earth system tipping points that we're trying to avoid. There is a whole section which I help to lead about the positive tipping points. It's possible to have tipping points in social human systems as well, whereby there are alternative stable states. And what we're trying to do is to go from the current unsustainable state of having a fossil fuel economy and tip it into a new renewable energy economy by making the desired innovations the most attractive and affordable and accessible alternatives. And if we can do that, then the rush to take advantage of those alternatives becomes sort of self-reinforcing, so it accelerates, and that's the point of the positive tipping points. We're trying to accelerate to the desired future that we want. And since our first report in 2023, we've witnessed rapid progress in the uptake of clean technologies worldwide, especially as I've mentioned already, with solar PV power and wind power and electric vehicles. So, for example, solar power is growing exponentially. It's doubling in capacity every 2 to 3 years. Solar power is now the cheapest form of power in most countries in the world. And it means that despite what's going on in the USA, the revolution to a clean technology energy future is unstoppable. Likewise, with electric vehicles, the sales of electric vehicles have increased 25% globally last year, and far faster than that in emerging markets, in especially in Asia, partly because the price of batteries, which is one of the major components of a car, have also dropped by 20 to 30% in that single year. So these transformations, these positive transformations in renewable energy provision, in electric vehicles, in batteries, all these things are reinforcing each other. And so, for example, the secondhand batteries, when electric vehicles' batteries have gone below sort of 80% power, they can be used by the electricity grid as a second use for batteries, and that helps balance the sort of renewable energy supply and demand problem. What happens when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine? So these different transformations are reinforcing each other, making renewable power ever cheaper and encouraging then electrification of mobility and making electric vehicles ever more cheaper. So we're on a positive, cascading, self-reinforcing transition of towards the renewable energy future, which is really good news. And of course, also the share of people globally who consider climate change to be a major threat continues to increase. So 80% of people worldwide want their country to do more on climate change, and 72% want their country to transition away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible. So there's some really good news out there. There's also been, as I'm sure you've heard, a real surge of climate litigation cases in the courts, which is really bringing countries to account and raising their ambitions. So our report puts all of these different positive news in a set of report cards, sector by sector, looking at, as I say, the solar industry, the renewable energy industry, the battery electrics, and also in buildings. There's a a positive tipping point with the provision of heat pumps, which is just about starting in leading countries. And then there are other possibilities for positive tipping, for example, in creating a regenerative agricultural farming system, and in the shift to sustainable diets, which we haven't had a very widespread evidence of yet. But there are ways to shift towards plant-rich and alternative protein diets, which are quite exciting. And so that there's lots of different ways that we can tip various systems to produce the kind of low carbon renewable future that we want.
Yeah, and so are there any policy levers identified in the report that could steer us away from reaching other tipping points and to start, doing the positive tipping points and not so negative all the time?
Yeah, well, one of the key points is that these positive tipping points, they don't just happen by themselves. They are they're not on sort of easy, quick fix way out of the climate crisis. They tend to be re the result of years and decades of grassroots advocacy and sometimes protest. For example, the Norway now has 95% of all new cars are electric, and they are sort of ahead of the curve, really, for other countries. But they only got to that point because there was a decades of activists, including the pop band a-ha, by the way. I'm not sure whether you're far too young to remember them, but yes, I mean, we have to remember that the policies that work to positively tip systems can be a long time coming. And some of the evidence-based analyses that we've done show that if you can introduce mandates, in other words, for example, if you can ban the future sale of fossil cars by a certain date, and also for fossil fuel trucks or for gas-fired boilers, if you can introduce a mandate that bans these things, that's generally the most effective policy to trigger these positive tipping points towards the clean energy innovations that we want and transition away from the fossil fuel alternatives. So, carbon taxation and all these things have a role in certain areas, but if we can introduce mandates that give people a very clear signal that this is the direction we're going, this is what's going to happen by, 2030 or 2035, part of our job is to persuade government how to create the most effective policy mixes to create the change that we need as fast as possible.
Yeah, and going back to something you said before, so we talked a little bit about global, we also talked about local, but you also said that 80% of people around the world care about climate change and care about making change and having our governments make change. So for listeners who might feel overwhelmed, a lot of them are, I know a lot of them have reached out and have explained how nervous they are and overwhelmed they are. What would you say is or even are some of the most important things to focus on from the report, and what can people do who are listening to take action?
Well, the report has a lot to be worried about. We're scientists. We can't. We just have to say what is happening. But also, there's an awful lot that is happening through all parts of society and the economy and in governments, which is really going well, where civil societies are engaged, especially at the city level, by the way. There seems to be sometimes when you get to these massive climate conferences, like in Brazil, where you've got 194 countries trying to all agree on the same thing, it can be too big. Other ways, when we do our individual actions, we can feel good about ourselves. But unless everybody else does the same, then our individual actions feel sometimes too small. But where you get to local action at the sort of town and city level, you can often find this sort of sweet spot of a certain population size in which people come together and they can tangibly see the results and the benefits of their actions. They come together and they create energy cooperatives, or they create food, local food cooperatives. And I think that the hope and the real energy and the action now is a lot is happening in place-based initiatives and city actions within towns and where people see things that where they say, wow, this is the kind of future I want to live in, that creates hope and that creates inspiration, where people say, well, if they can do it there, why can't we do it here? And that's the kind of motivation that we need. For example, I went to Copenhagen recently, and walking through the center of Copenhagen, I could hear the birds singing in the trees. That's not something I could say in New York City, but there's no reason why New York City couldn't have that.
Yeah, that is so powerful. Again, going back to that imagining the future we want to build. We want to be able to hear birds and wildlife back in the city and not just pigeons. Not that I don't love pigeons. I think pigeons are great, but having more biological diversity, the variety of life. So, and one of those important things that you talked about is kind of building that community, getting involved in your community. And that's something we try to talk about the Hopeful Environmentalists too, is really just getting involved, finding opportunities to get involved with local organizations, local politics, whatever it might be, just get involved. And kind of to wrap us up, I always love to, end on hope. So what gives you hope after working on such a difficult and scary report? What gives you hope for the future?
If hope means the expectation that everything will work out fine, that's not the kind of hope that gives me energy, that makes me carry on. I have a sort of a realistic hope that regardless of how things turn out, this is how I want to spend my life. And there's an old saying that's attributed to Martin Luther, but I don't know who said it, but it goes something like, even if I knew that the world would end tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree. So I just love doing what I'm doing, and I think it's the right thing to do. And I find a great inspiration with people, especially, as I say, doing wonderful local things in their own little way in their local towns, which make it all worthwhile.
I love that. Yeah, no, I definitely draw inspiration from just doing what we can. That's all we can do is doing what we can, continuing to advocate, continuing to get involved, continuing to take action. So I really appreciate everything that you shared with us today. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we wrap up?
Oh, just that we do need to be hopeful, and change, some of the change is scary, but the amazing thing is that change, good change, is happening faster than you think.
I love that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Taylor.
And that wraps up this episode of The Hopeful Environmentalists. I hope that you really enjoyed this episode, but also got a lot out of it, learning what a global tipping point is, what this report is actually saying, and kind of leaving that doom and gloom behind and moving into this mindset of action, of creating a future we all deserve. Not inaction and feeling like, okay, well, I heard some positive things, time to sit back and let other people do it. No, it's time to roll up our sleeves, every single one of us listening. We all have a role to play. It's time to roll up our sleeves and take action so that we don't pass any more global tipping points and that we protect what we currently have. If you still have questions regarding the Global Tipping Points report, feel free to reach out and I will do my best to get an answer for you. And as always, remember to stay hopeful and create positive change.